Hello and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Self. I am your host, Africa, and today I am not alone. And this is really important because I'm going to be very honest about something. I enjoy my favorite podcasters when they do solo episodes more than when they have guest episodes. And it's because I'm much more interested in hearing what is actually raw and what is real and what is true to them, especially in real time. And I think sometimes guest episodes can throw off that rhythm and that intimacy that I have with them. So I say that because I am very intentional about who I have on the podcast. And today I have someone that truly excites me, someone whose work has been very important to me as I've been going through heartbreak quite consistently for the past year. And she will tell you a little bit more about herself, and I will share everything about her and where to find her in the show notes of this episode, including her incredible book, which she is not here to peddle, by the way, but I genuinely just love this fucking book, and she knows it's brilliant as well. Anyway, let me introduce you to the wonderful, wonderful poet, writer, self-proclaimed oversharer, Rebecca Archer. Hello, my darling.
Hello, Africa. Thank you for such a beautiful introduction. I'm a bit speechless by those beautiful things you just said, so thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. No, really, I can't wait to share more about this book, not just in this episode, but generally, because it has been very, very helpful. So the book is called Heartbreak, but if you break it down, it's He Art Break. And Rebecca will tell you more about that. But I'm curious to know, Becca, how are you feeling right now in this moment in time? How are you feeling?
Well, currently in this very moment, I am going through a heartbreak myself, which is interesting because the book began when I was going through heartbreak, and a lot of the book helped me heal in so many ways. I don't know about you, but I find writing such a therapeutic tool, and I began a therapy journey a few years ago. And after every therapy session, I would go home and I would just journal about everything that I'd learned in the therapy sessions and everything that was going on for me in life. And by doing that, I learned so much about myself that I was able to link into all the things that I was learning in therapy as well. So I remember hearing you say on previous podcasts that you have quite an avoidant attachment style. And I realized, particularly by writing it down, that I have quite an anxious attachment style, and I am very attracted to the avoidant. The anxious avoidant trap is something that I find myself in very regularly, and it's a reoccurring pattern for me. And yeah, the book helped me explore and understand that. And it also made me realize that I have a tendency for limerence and fantasy bonding, which are therapy concepts I really got into. And I think that stems from an attachment hunger. So when you have been single for a long period of time and you're quite an anxious person, if someone comes into your life and they seem very open-hearted, particularly if you're a writer, I don't know if you find this, Africa, but being a writer, if somebody gives me a blank page, I go to town on that blank page and I write a whole chapter and a whole story. So that's a lot of the things that I discovered about myself from writing and therapy combined.
I could feel that as you were speaking. And I also don't think it's accidental in a lot of ways that you and I have finally been able to sit down. And the time that we are able to sit down, we're both going through heartbreak and in what I think of as a grief cave. And this is why some of the things that we're going to explore just through conversation, but also things that you have written and shared with the world are going to be very important in this episode. And I seem to be speaking to a lot of women, particularly who are in this very transitional period when it comes to relationships. So there is something happening right now in this moment in time. And you said the words, or the terms, limerence and fantasy bonding. What is limerence? It's something that I've heard, but I'm not quite sure what it actually is.
So I actually, my last partner sent me a book called, what is it called? It escapes me. Enduring Love, it's called. And it's about a hot air balloon crash and how it brings people together. But there is a concept in there about limerence, about if you had past trauma in your life, and that can be relational trauma. It doesn't have to be what I would call a big T trauma. It can be if you've kind of been abandoned previously in romantic relationship, you are more likely to cling on to anything that feels like a life raft in that difficult time. So you might see somebody who seems very open-hearted, but you project all the things that you anticipate that that relationship could be onto them without having any actual real understanding about who they are as a person and how compatible you might be. Because that's another thing that I found that I do, is I've for years in my life confused chemistry with compatibility, and that's something I'm really working on. So people who have a tendency to lean towards fantasy bonding or limerence will focus on what they feel, all those butterflies they feel when they initially meet somebody, but they won't get into the nitty-gritty of, okay, so how are we actually compatible? What are our life goals? What are we striving for as a partnership? It just becomes driven by this chemistry and this fantasy of what could potentially be, and it's not based in any facts whatsoever.
Oh gosh, I feel that so fucking deeply, because I think that was a big contributing factor to the ending of my most recent relationship. And I've mentioned this many times in previous episodes, but the reason why this was very difficult to hold, the reality that I'd deeply fallen for this person's potential, was which is kind of what I'm hearing when you break down what limerence is, right? It's kind of seeing this potential in this person and almost behaving and treating them and treating that relationship as if they are already those things, and then eventually realizing that they are not. But it's a very complex thing, and I felt a lot of shame actually around it, which I hadn't realized before. I felt a lot of shame in moments when I would want to have the conversation of, okay, so what is your vision? What are actually your ambitions in life? What is your, what is it that you actually want? What are your goals? What is all these reality-based things? Because we'd fallen so deeply in each other. And definitely, when we would be together in our bubble, it's almost like the relationship worked when we were in our bubble, where I projected all of these things onto him. But the moment that we would bring our relationship to the outside world, to the wider world, to reality, I saw my projection and I couldn't unsee it. I don't know if you resonate with that, where you'll see that this relationship only seems to work when we're in our bubble, where I can continue projecting these things onto you. And this thing of potential, I can see it in you. A part of me wants to bring it out of you. And then when we go out into the world, we're shown that this relationship actually cannot function, you know.
Absolutely, Africa. I hard relate to what you just said, because another pattern that I have, and this is one thing I realized when I wrote my book, is a lot of my behavior in dating was driven by a deep-seated fear of abandonment. And if you have a deep-seated fear of abandonment, and it's interesting because I know you're avoidant and I'm anxious, but I'm still very anxious about getting too close to somebody. If I meet somebody on a first date, for example, and they're like, I want to settle down, I want to have kids, I want to get married, they might just be talking about that in general in life. But I take that very specifically as related to me. And historically, I've ran away from that. And so what I found by writing my book is that I was very attracted to men who were emotionally, but also geographically unavailable to me. So I would form relationships with people who lived in a different country to me, or even lived kind of in a different city to me. And my most recent partner was in the UK, but we were in different cities.
Right.
And that allowed the fantasy bonding and the limerence and the projections, because we didn't have to do real life together. it was that we would have these beautiful, like we'd go on a holiday together, or we'd have these really like long weekends together, where, like you say, you would live in a little bubble and we wouldn't really engage with each other's friends that much or each other's family. It was just this perfection of romance. And there wasn't that much space for the nitty-gritty around that of doing real life. So I do really relate to what you say about this romance bubble, because it's something I've always found myself in.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, especially women, really do. And I'm curious, because you speak quite a bit about dating apps, which is how you and I were connected, actually.
Yes.
I think this might have been last summer or sometime last year, when I had broken up for the second time with my ex, because we were in this on and off cycle, which I have never been in with anyone ever before. And the story that I have of me is that I'm not the person that would tolerate an on and off cycle. But because I truly believed that I was asking for too much because of some of the standards that I had, which at the time were positioned as unrealistic expectations in terms of the kind of man that I want to be with. And what I mean specifically by that is, I've really learned that I do need to be with someone who has a vision for their life.
Yeah.
I really want to be with someone who is also, and the vision doesn't have to be identical to mine. The vision doesn't mean that you need to be doing similar work to me, but it means that we're both independently on our paths in life, and I get to support and be an expander for you in your vision and what it is you want to create. And you can do the same for me. And we bring our worlds together and we create a life that makes sense and is pleasurable and fulfilling for both of us. But I found myself in a situation where my relationship, the relationship I was in, ended up holding a mirror up to my partner, where he realized that he hadn't thought about what he wants to do in life.
Mm-hmm.
But he's found himself in a relationship with a woman who's already successful in what she does, knows that she wants to create more in her life, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this thing of, okay, I see so much potential in this person and I love this person so much that I want to be there to bring it out of them. But who is pouring into me as I do that? Because I don't want to be a coach in my relationship. I don't want to be a consultant in my relationship. That's my daily work. It's what I do anyway. I don't want to end up mentoring my partner, you know? But then I thought, am I being impatient? Maybe it's just my impatience, which is where the on and off happened. After a few months, you know, it would be a thing of, maybe I'm just being impatient. Maybe it's that thing, you know, of the modern day woman who wants way too much, et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of shamed and guilted myself into trying again. And I'll also say, I wanted to try again because I truly love this man. And I know that I always will. He's incredible. But it's the compatibility thing you were saying. Chemistry, deep chemistry, and beautiful sex and sensuality and feeling spiritually bonded does not necessarily translate to compatibility in a long-term partnership. It just doesn't, right?
No. And I've spent 10 years kind of on this life lesson, and it's so interesting. The dynamic you just talk about with your previous partner is exactly the dynamic I've been in, an on-off dynamic. And like you say, it's normally something I wouldn't tolerate, but within that partnership is a deep, deep love and a deep, deep respect and a deep, deep emotional understanding of one another as well, like I've never had before. And so that is very hard to walk away from. So I really understand that.
Yeah. And I was, so it was in that time that I found you. When we had broken up a couple of times and maybe the longest period of separation at that time was 2.5 months or something like that, which when you have built that bubble with someone feels like a lifetime to be away from them for 2 entire months. So I did what most people probably do, is that I try to fill that space with dating apps, because my rational mind was like, well, now I know what it is that I want. I know what it is that I'm looking for. Dating apps make it stupidly easy because you can pick, it's like a menu. I want this, I want that. You have to live in this area and, you know, pick my three prompts, get as specific as possible so I can reel in the right person. And you have that initial excitement and even exhilaration and even just this newfound sense of self, sense of knowing who the fuck I am and what it is I'm looking for. So it feels a little bit exciting in the beginning. And I've seen this pattern. I haven't been on dating apps too much, but enough to notice the pattern of when I feel like I'm on this sort of high, and just wanting to feel desired and a kind of really appreciating just how many people are choosing me, you know, in this moment in time. You look and then 10 minutes later, it's like a horde of other men. And then it quickly starts to change for me. I slowly start to feel kind of a sense of urgency within myself, even when I'm not actually on the app. Just having it on my phone builds a sense of urgency within me. And then the sense of urgency start to translate in me not being as patient anymore and actually looking at each person individually. Then the disposability comes in.
Yeah.
And then I witness myself behaving in a way that is very unnatural, but I know what we're here to do on this app. So it's by design, you know. And then just starting to feel very empty. So I'll kind of stop there in terms of how I found you. I shared this with my audience and so many people sent comments. So many people were like, hey, we've noticed these problems too with dating apps. They make us behave in a way that is completely unnatural to the way that we would in person. You start to pick at things you normally wouldn't pick at. And then you sent me a piece that you had written, which I will read out in just a moment. And it synced so deeply into me that it's something that I share with people in my day-to-day life so much, especially now that I have your book. I share it all the time. I've taken photos of it and I share it with people. Yes, because it captures this big modern experience that people are having, but having so much trouble actually finding the language to describe what these odd, complex, layered feelings are. So that's how I found you and why I think you're a very important voice when it comes to the conversations around modern dating. So I've thrown a lot at you, but I'd love to know kind of your story and experience with modern dating and dating apps particularly, and then that piece you ended up writing.
Yeah, so dating apps, how it all kind of began, even the book in itself as a concept, was in, I think it was 2018. I was just approaching my 30th birthday and I got a notification from Tinder, which came up with all confetti on my screen. And there was, I think there was like some sort of fanfare on it as well. And it said, "Congratulations, Rebecca, you have been liked by 25,000 men on Tinder." And I literally wanted to cry, not in a happy way. I wanted to cry because I had spent 10 years on and off after the ending of my last long-term relationship on dating apps, trying to fill a void within me. And that statistic, the 25,000 men had been like, yeah, I tapped that. But none of them had actually wanted to obviously I hadn't been on a date with 25,000 men. But
you'd be a very busy woman.
I was quite picky still about who I actually went on dates with, but of those 25,000 that I decided that I wanted to match with and communicate with and go on dates with, I found myself in a reoccurring cycle of situationships where I would, and I wasn't really using the dating apps, I wasn't using it for casual hookups, because I know that a lot of people use dating apps and they just want, you know, to fulfill a very certain need in one night. That's not what I was doing it for. And I would find myself in these situations with men where I was like the girlfriend experience for them. So they might have just come out of a long-term relationship themselves and they were wanting someone to fill the void of their girlfriend, but they didn't want to give the commitment of being my partner. So, you know, we'd go for walks in the park or we'd talk about books, or it, on the surface, it would seem like a proper connection. And actually, it's interesting. If someone holds my hand, it feels like a very intimate thing with me. So I'd be in these sort of situationships with men for sort of 3 months at a time. And if they held my hand, in my head, I was like, that means something. That means that this is an actual situation. But then they would ghost me or they would disappear and I would never hear from them ever again. And I remember my mum, who has been married to my dad for years and years and years, and they've only really ever been in a serious relationship with each other. And she just couldn't comprehend what I was going through. She said, I don't understand, Rebecca. You have a good job. You have your own house. You're all right looking. Why are you not finding someone who wants to build a life with you? And why are these men treating you so disposably? And so I kind of went away and came up with this sushi analogy, which is how you found me, which was my way of trying to explain to my mum what it feels like dating right now, since dating apps came around. And how I described it was like a sushi belt. And I felt like I was a piece of sushi on a belt that was rotating around in people's phones. And they could, you know, they could pick me off the belt and they could try me. And I might whet their appetite initially. But the problem is there's so many different types of sushi like whizzing past their eyes. So why would you commit to one type of sushi when you can have salmon nigiri or, you know, teriyaki chicken? There's so many different bits to choose from. So my analogy was that that's why so many people are turning vegan, because they're just sick of sushi. And and suddenly my mum kind of understood that. And it's interesting because that also links into the psychology theory of hunger, attachment hunger, where if you are starved of, and I was getting affection in like physical affection in terms of like kissing or hugging or people flirting with me, but I wasn't having, I was starved of emotional intimacy for so long. I was starved of knowing that a person that I was dating would actually be there for me if shit hit the fan,
right?
Would they be there to pick me up? And for 10 years, no. So I became very hyper independent and I developed this attachment hunger, which is the link as well to sushi, because I think so many people have been starved of, they can get physical intimacy very, very easily, but that cheapens it. And if you cheapen physical intimacy, then it also skips the need with a lot of people. They miss the most important part to me, which is the emotional intimacy. And that's what I think people are starving from. They're starving from emotional intimacy.
Yeah, I agree. I love that so much. And I'll actually read out the piece. And this is from Rebecca Archer's book, Heartbreak. And what I love about the way that you wrote this as well is that you've organized the book through the seven deadly sins, right? I think it's so smart. And when people get their hands on it, which I know they will after this conversation, because that to me, and I really say this truthfully, there's just nothing like this in terms of, there are people having conversations about modern dating and it's usually through a very academic, jargony lens, or either it's people in the red pill community, it's male dominated podcast, or it's a singular idea of man needs to be providing, if he wanted to he would, etc. We're just hearing things that are very kind of not really tapping into the beauty and the rawness of love through a very philosophical lens and through a creative storytelling lens. That's why I think your book is very, very important. And your poem, I Am Sushi, is from the first section, The Promiscuous Heart. And it reads, I am sushi, raw and waiting to be picked. I am fast food. Online dating is takeaway for the lonely. I am snack. I am a snack, temporarily satiating my date's hunger. I am an option. Your appetite is wet. I am reeled in. Then you throw me back in the water. I am single again. I am deleting the apps. Oh, it's beautiful.
Thank you. It's so beautiful actually to hear somebody else read it out. I've never heard anybody else read my words out before, so it's very powerful to hear them read by you. So thank you.
Oh, what an honor. It is so beautiful. And I'm really curious and want to get honest about that last sentence, because it is so powerful and I have said it so many fucking times, and then lo and behold, I re-downloaded Hinge. So let's talk about that last line. I am deleting the apps. When you wrote that, or when you felt that strongly, is it something that you told yourself many times?
Yes, I've definitely been like dipping my fishing rod back and forth in that dating app pond for sure. Because interestingly, I think it was 2021 where we'd obviously experienced the horror that was 2020. And then we went into 2021, and I was, because when I was during 2020, I was on dating apps a lot. It was the only way that I could kind of connect with the outside world. And I didn't beat myself up about that. But then I'd had so many situationships in 2020 that smashed my heart that I decided, no, 2021, no more dating apps for me. And I didn't go on dating app dates in 2021. And actually my most recent partner, I met him in real life. And that was a beautiful thing. And I feel like I'd almost forgotten how to meet people in real life. Because when we've been socially isolated and kind of trapped in our homes and for so long, you lose a lot of that skill set that you had before. And so I made a conscious effort in 2021 that I wanted to meet people in real life, and it paid off for me. And I was in a relationship on and off like you were for a couple of years. But when that most recent relationship has come to an end, I had a moment of weakness, because we're in a period at the moment where it's been the longest we've ever not spoken to one another. Over the course of our relationship, the longest we've ever gone when we've had a wobble is a couple of weeks. And at the moment, it's been about 6 weeks since we've spoken to each other. And it does feel like a gaping hole in my life of not being able to speak to that person. So I went on some dating. I downloaded Hinge, and I went on Hinge, and I went on a date, a couple of dates, and it was okay. But the mad thing, Africa, is that I'd seen before I went on this date that you'd posted something about how other people's disappointment in you is not yours to hold. And this man, and he was a nice man, I don't have anything bad to say about him, but he did end the dating because he said he was disappointed in me because of my view on a political stance. And I just wanted to screenshot what you'd sent him. I wanted to screenshot what you had posted on your Instagram about how, you know, your disappointment is not mine to hold.
Right.
And I do think, because we agreed on so many things politically, he assumed that we would agree on everything, which is an unrealistic expectation to have of somebody. And I hope when I'm dating that I make space for different people's viewpoints, because that's what makes life interesting. And you don't want to date a carbon copy of yourself. But I found a lot of inner strength from that post that you shared about the disappointment thing, because it's something that it's been a reoccurring theme in my life. And I think when you start to find a voice and you start to really know who you are deep down in your soul, what you stand for, what you're looking for in life, what your basic needs are. If you've been a person, and I think this was me, who wasn't very good at expressing what I needed from even friends and romantic partners, when suddenly you find the inner strength to be able to share what it is that you really need, that can be very disappointing for some people, because it's almost the death of the person that they thought you were.
Gosh, That's incredibly powerful, and I'm so with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just made me in this moment apply that very thing that I said on the disappointment of others not being yours to hold, mm-hmm. into dating and romance. And I don't think I've applied it there in that specific mm-hmm. way, almost like I've applied it intuitively. But right now, full transparency, even at the time of this recording, I'm in a little bit of a conflict with my ex, because we found ourselves again trying to see if there's some kind of possibility mm-hmm. of being in each other's lives, right? If it's not going to be romantic, and we don't want to force a friendship, but we know that we're going to be, or rather want to be, in each other's lives, what does that look like? So naturally, we ended up falling into kind of a romance. And then, of course, you can tell what's going to happen after that. So there are some difficult conversations that we're having right now in real time. And each time, I don't know if you've had this too, each time, what I really commend this for is that we've been more able to have difficult conversations. The way that we're able to communicate has got better and better mm-hmm. and better. I do notice the differences. We're able to hold the discomfort a little bit more. I'm able to be braver in saying what it is that I need to say. But there is always that thing of, and we never want to think of it that way. But for me, if I'm being completely honest with myself, I sometimes feel like, am I disappointing him by choosing myself? So many times I've felt that. And it's so interesting how I do not feel that in any other area of life.
Mm-hmm.
I've always said, even on this podcast, everywhere else, that my romantic relationships are my best teacher, because that's where I see the smaller part of me really come out to play. The part of me that feels like I have to please. The part of me that consciously knows all of these things, but for whatever reason, I will feel as if, but I can't say that. I would rather, I even think of romantic relationships, I would rather be uncomfortable in a sexual experience than to say, hey, I'm experiencing pain right now. I remember doing that as a young girl and even into my 20s, not being able to say what my needs were, or to say, actually, this doesn't feel so good, or I want to do this other thing. And then that shows itself in every other dynamic, you know. But I've found that romantic relationships are my best teacher, because I think that's where I have had the history of being willing to cross my own boundaries.
I relate very closely to that, because it's interesting, just from seeing you on social media and meeting you in real life a couple of times, I think we're very similar in that in our work lives, we don't take any shit. We, you know, we're very clear about what we expect and what we want to achieve and what our expectations are. Like, for example, with my book, I had such a clear vision of how it had to be. And even if it didn't necessarily make sense to people outside of me, I was like, no, this is how I'm doing it. But
yes.
Where I struggle in my life is having boundaries in romantic relationship, because, and that goes down to like inner child Rebecca, who thinks that I'm not worthy and thinks that if I have needs, then I might get abandoned. And that comes from kind of my early romantic relationship experiences, things ending very suddenly without explanation. And then that continuing when I got into the dating app world. So, yeah, I've learned so much about myself in dating. And my most recent relationship, as painful as it is at the moment, I know that it's founded on deep love and deep respect. And I do hope that we can always be in each other's lives. But I think the biggest issue that my ex had with me was that I wasn't very good at telling him what my expectations were for the relationship. So I just turned 35 and society keeps asking me, so Rebecca, do you want kids? And this has become a reoccurring theme in my life, because now that I'm 35, I am officially would be called a geriatric mother. Did you know this? People,
no.
When you are 35, if you go into a hospital environment pregnant, you are geriatric. And they like to tell you, because My friends over the age of 35 are going through this at the moment, and just the fear that is constantly pushed to them in the narrative around how risky this is because they're over 35. And also the messaging that is continuously pushed to us around your egg supply and how it's depleting daily. And these are sort of big life questions that, I'll be honest with you, I don't have the answer to. I don't know if I want kids. I'm kind of on the fence about it at the moment. And all I can reassure myself on that is every other aspect of my life, when I've known for sure and it's been a hard yes, then I have pursued that. Whereas where I'm at the moment is, I think if I became pregnant one day, it's something that I would lean into and I would see it as a blessing and it would be wonderful. But also, if I never had a child, I know that I've reached a place of contentment that I know that I would be happy in life because I enjoy my life and the people in it and the things that I'm experiencing. But society, even your most inner romantic relationships, find that very hard to sit with that uncertainty of maybe.
Yeah. Oh, I really, first of all, I'm still trying to fucking process that if you're 35, you are
geriatric.
That's wild, because to me at 35 in 2024 is like 23 or 24 in
terms
of
how we experience. Yeah.
In terms of how we experience time and age now. So I'm just trying to let that sink in. I really want to know, Rebecca, what would you say for you as you reflect on your past relationships, maybe even your most recent one, where do you think, or rather, what do your non-negotiables look like now? What are the things that you're willing to say, actually, this is what it is that I desire. This is what I'm willing to negotiate on. This is what I won't negotiate on. Do you have any of those things?
Yes, I think I've become a lot clearer about what it is that I want in the fundamentals. So I won't entertain anything casual anymore. I'm not interested. I'm happy. I've been reading about this psychology concept of pacing, and that's something that I'm really holding on to, because I think in the dating app culture, a lot of people think, okay, if I'm not physically intimate with him on the third date, then he's just going to find somebody else and that will sleep with him. And I think, well, if you think I'm that disposable and you won't wait around and get to know me before the physical intimacy, then off you go. Like, have a nice life. That's something that I would entertain more previously that I just won't do anymore. And it's like, we will go at a pace that I am comfortable with. In fact, not just me, that we're both comfortable at, because I think it applies both. I think it applies to both sexes, because I think men often feel an obligation these days as well, that the sex must come on this number of dates. And
right.
And I think that's a pressure that is really not spoken about for men. So for me, it's about, I now pursue friendship before I pursue anything romantically intimate. It's not, that is a negotiable, non-negotiable for me. They have to be someone that I trust to be my friend and someone who I respect and who respects me and can hold space for my, like, all corners of my personality. So they can be there for me when I'm happy and succeeding, because that's when, you know, most people will turn up, when you're doing really good things in life. But there are few people who will turn up for you when you are sobbing on the kitchen floor, and you know, on those dark days in life, you need someone who can be there for you then too. So what I have learned to be comfortable in, and this is what I realized when I went back on the dating apps and did a few dating app dates when I first became single, it was not the same girl that used to use dating apps, because I didn't need the validation from a random stranger anymore. And I walked away from the date thinking, yes, he was nice, but if I never hear from him ever again, the life goes on. And I prioritize my own happiness now, in terms of, I don't And there's a poem in the book called If Not Now, When? And it's about how when I was younger, I had all these dreams and places I wanted to go and things I wanted to do. And I thought, oh, I'll do that when I have a partner.
Right.
And I think so many of us do that. We postpone things for when we have a boyfriend or when we're engaged or when we're married or when we have kids. And I refuse to do that anymore. So I recently just went on a little holiday to Istanbul, and my friend came with me, and that was something that I'd initially really wanted to do with my partner. But when the relationship broke down, I thought, no, I'm going to take my friend. And if my friend hadn't been available, I would have gone on my own. And I think traveling, I don't know if you've ever traveled on your own before, but I've learned so much about myself and learned how to be comfortable in my own space. And I do need people. I need people. I need community. I need love. I need friendship. And I don't want to become hyper independent so that I kind of push those things out. But if for any reason people that I love aren't available to enjoy experiences with me, I know now that I can enjoy those experiences on my own. Absolutely. And that's quite a liberating thing, I think.
It 100% is. And it's very interesting because for me, as someone that has been historically avoidant, and I'm very careful with the language I use around this. And I remember recording a podcast episode not too long ago talking about when attachment style labels can become a trap. Because I realized that I was going into relationships and interactions once I had discovered the language of attachment style. It was very liberating to begin with because finally everything made sense. I think language is so potent and beautiful because it allows for you to describe your inner world and to put pieces together. So it was very useful in that. But what wasn't useful for me was to start to analyze my behavior in the sense of, I'm doing this because I'm avoidant. This doesn't feel good because I'm avoidant. And at some point it just became the kind of this golden cage. It freed me because I finally had the language to describe my experience, but now I was trapping myself in the language that just was describing my experience, not who I am. Mm-hmm. Because I realized, actually, I'm very secure with my friends. I'm very secure with my friends, and I'm secure with certain people within my family. And then I'm more avoidant with other people, maybe that remind me of my family of origin and the home that I grew up in. I realized that it was much more nuanced than that, but I wasn't giving myself credit for where I am secure. And I realized that, yes, historically I've been more avoidant, but actually when I look into it more, I think it would be closer to fearful avoidant, which is that I'm very intimate and I want love, but then when I get it, I'll pull away. For me, as someone that grew up quite independently because of family circumstances, etc., had to take care of myself, and my siblings had to as well, from a very young age, I'm so comfortable being alone. Solitude is my default. I love my own space. I love going away by myself. I go to the theater by myself all the time. Beautiful, fancy couple dinners by myself all the time. Luxury hotels, which are apparently just for couples, by myself all the time. So I really enjoy that. I've had to learn, Rebecca, is letting people join me on those experiences, because I felt at time that they're encroaching on my personal space. So that is where those avoidant tendencies can come in, where you feel like, okay, I will let you in, but I'm only going to keep you at arm's length. Or I would have this thing where I'd travel with my partner, and let's say we're away for 7 days or 10 days. By day three, I would just want him to just leave me alone. Like, just leave me. Like, why are you here, stranger, when he's been my boyfriend for 4 years? So it would be this thing. But then I realized I was also not communicating my need for space. So that need for space would look like, silent treatment. It would look like suddenly being passive aggressive, starting to resent him because he wants to get closer, but it's actually not his fault because I'm not communicating that actually maybe once it comes to date three or four, babe, you go and do your thing. I'll do mine. We'll come back together because I'm the kind of person I need room to miss you because that super, super closeness doesn't feel so good for me. But then also, I need to allow myself to accept that closeness and intimacy, let people love me. You know, that's been a big message for me. So I relate to what you're saying, but just in a different way. So for me, it's about bringing people in more because solitude is so much of where a lot of my pleasure comes from.
It's interesting because I've definitely... my most recent relationships have been with people that present just like you. They're like very wanting intimacy and then they like have to take space from me. And that's not because the love goes away, but it's just, they just need the space and they need to have their experiences for themselves. And as I've become more secure in myself, I'm like, okay, go have a nice time.
Yeah.
And for the outside world, a lot of people find that very uncomfortable and they don't understand it. So my most recent relationship, he would like travel sometimes for 2 months at a time. And I was so happy for him though, because we would contact each other all the time and he would come back such an enriched version of himself after having this experience that he needed to have in his life.
Yes.
And definitely the old version of me would not have been able to hold space for that because I would have been consumed with jealousy and anxiety about what was happening. But I now know that there are some people in the world, just like I like to go on holiday on my own, there are lots of people that like to go on holiday on their own. And just because you become in a relationship does not mean that those elements of your personality disappear completely. But it is about finding a compromise of time spent together.
One, I love that you say that because what I had to own up to, and I speak to a lot of my friends who tend to be men mostly who are also avoidant, but I think I'm a woman who's historically avoidant, which is usually sort of seen as kind of a more masculine way of being. But what I had to own up to was that it was... my needs are not the only ones that matter in a relationship. No. Just because I need distance does not mean I get to use that as a form of control, trying to control how close we get. Because I think what tends to happen with that anxious avoidant dynamic is typically the avoidant person is somewhat in control of the relationship. They control the closeness or the distance. They control how much intimacy you're going to get or how much you're not going to get. And I started to realize for myself just how manipulative that is. Yes, I get to honor my nature, the way that I do things. Yes, I need space. But also, Africa, you have to communicate lovingly with the person that you need space. The person shouldn't just find out that you need space because you're emitting this energy and communicating to them that they're too needy, so I need space. That's not fair, you know?
No.
So I had to realize that there is something to be said about honoring my nature, but also getting curious as to, is that actually my true nature? Or was I nurtured in an environment that was unsafe, where I was never really hugged, never really shown emotional intimacy? So now that I have a partner who's showing that to me, it feels stifling and suffocating. So I've really had to be really fucking honest about what I get to keep and what I actually need to deal with and heal, because I realized that I was trying to control the relationship by taking that much space. Because I think space is needed for closeness, absolutely. But I think it's the quality of the space and how you express your need of it, right?
And I definitely understand that, because I think from a different perspective as an anxious person, being away from somebody allows me to feel control from a different way, I guess, because I have always had a perception of every relationship I have ever gone into that they will eventually abandon me and I will never hear from them ever again. And so if somebody's like, yeah, I need to go to this country in the world, or I live in a different place from you, because we're not physically close all the time, when the abandonment, which I have turned into a self-fulfilling prophecy, eventually happens, I'm like, oh, okay, well, they weren't around me anyway, so it's easier for me to manage. And that is definitely a pattern that I have reoccurred, because it feels easier for me to control myself and my reactions to that situation.
Right. And what does it look like now? If you were to get into another relationship again, or make the relationship that you were in work so it can be supportive for both of you, how would you love differently, if you will?
I had listened to a podcast episode you did recently. I think it was quite recently, but it was talking about sort of in family situations or friendship situations, or even in romantic relationships, particularly in romantic relationships, if something felt off to you, you would find it really hard to say what felt off. Or, and I have been very, placid maybe isn't the right word, but I'm non-confrontational. In the world, in work, I can be confrontational when I need to be confrontational. I set boundaries very clearly. But in my romantic relationships, I find it so difficult to set boundaries about this is what I expect, this is the behavior I expect. And even, you know, how you were saying about when you feel overwhelmed and you pull away. For me, a way of managing that, if I was to go forward with my old relationship or to start a new one, is that if you need space, you need to communicate to me, I'm feeling overwhelmed. It's not about you. I just need 24 hours. I'm going to contact you at this time tomorrow and we will repair this. I'm not going anywhere. Those sorts of things would really help me and help me feel more secure in the situation. But the other thing, my therapist told me, and I'm going to have to find the name of the author, but she told me to read this book called Fierce Conversations, which, and there's another book that I actually listened to on Audible called, I think it's called Fierce Love, but I can send it to you after this recording.
Please, please.
But the Fierce Love one blew my mind, and actually it made me cry, because she said no romantic relationship ends suddenly, because I kept saying to her, every relationship I'm in, it just ends suddenly and I don't know why. And this book said no romantic relationship, unless there is a death, obviously there are a few times when things can end suddenly, but if there is no death, no romantic relationship ends suddenly, it ends gradually because of a series of missed conversations. And the level of importance of those conversations can vary. So some of those conversations can seem quite minimal, but over the course of time, if both of you are not having the conversations about what is annoying you, what is triggering you, what you need, that eventually one of you is going to not be able to hold that anymore and it's just going to blow up. And I do think that is something that I am guilty of. And so going forward, in any romantic relationship I am in, I want to practice these fierce conversations, because if you're scared about talking about the nitty-gritty stuff, then you're only hurting yourself in the long run, because to your partner that can come across as indifference. If you're not, if say your partner goes away for a set amount of time and doesn't communicate with you, and you're not questioning as to why that's happening, that can come across to them as indifference, when really you're like, oh my gosh, why are they not talking to me?
Yes, yes. Oh, that's huge. That's a big one. And I really appreciate actually hearing from you what you experience as someone who sees themselves as more anxious in a relationship. I think it's important, because usually when those conversations are had around the anxious, avoidant, etc., it's usually almost like a blame game of who is the one that is failing us in this dynamic, and who is the one that needs to do their own work. But I think when we really understand that something that could be seemingly simple to one person can mean an entirely different thing to someone else. And how actually communicating that thing of being like, okay, I need a little bit of time. By the way, I love you. This is not about you. I just need space because my mind works in that way. It can change so much. But historically for me, I've known consciously that I need to do that. But for whatever reason, it's like my mind, it's almost like I can't get the words out. It's like there's a deep vulnerability in even saying it. I've spoken before about having moments in the past where I would be in conflict with my partner, and I always used to end up choosing partners who were also conflict avoidant. So eventually we would let things pile up, and then eventually one of us has to address it because we have no choice, especially when we live together. And there would be moments in conflict where my partner's talking about something, or maybe they don't feel valued in the relationship because I'm doing something, usually in the realm of silent treatment or being passive aggressive in some way, just very indirectly communicating. And I'd be able to see, okay, my partner is upset right now. And what would make it better in this situation is if even I lean in and just put my hand on his knee to show him that, okay, we're in a moment of conflict right now, but I'm not against you. I'm right here, you know, or I knew that reaching and hugging him would make that situation better. But for whatever reason, I just wouldn't be able to do it. I just wouldn't. I would know consciously what it is that I need to do. Many moments that I've known I need to communicate this thing, it's like whatever story I have about myself just will not allow me to do that. And then when I looked back on it, I realized that because I'm someone that doesn't think that every single thing comes back to childhood, you know, I don't. But I think most things actually do, especially for me when it comes to intimacy and general avoidance. So I realized that in those moments where now I'm an adult, but I'm sitting across my partner on the sofa and I can't even reach for them to tell them that I'm here. No one ever did that for me when I was growing up, when I was a child. Even when I would have been in trouble, or when I was bullied in school, or when I needed something, when I had my period for the first time, there was always this feeling of I'm in trouble. I'll get in trouble. If I say what it is that I need, or if I'm vulnerable, I'll be in trouble. So as an adult, I cheated in some of my earlier relationships because I felt like if I share my needs with my partner, I only know this retrospectively now, but if I share my needs with my partner, they won't actually honor my needs. I'm just going to be punished for even having needs to begin with. So I got them met elsewhere. So it's a very interesting thing how there's so many of these things that I've always known consciously, and most avoidant people, I would say a lot of it, they know exactly what they need to do. They know that it's about texting you and saying, hey, I know I haven't said anything for the past half day, but I want you to know that everything is okay. There's just a lot on my, whatever it is, but there's this thing, I don't know what it is, this inner resistance. Maybe it's vulnerability avoidance, but there's this resistance that stops them from actually reaching for the person. So then that's why it becomes self-sabotage, because you know exactly what you're supposed to do, but then you sabotage it, because sabotaging it means that we don't have to get close, which is what you don't want to do anyway. You have a bigger commitment to never building intimacy with anyone. So if I reach for you in this moment and hug you, will become even more intimate, and I don't want that, or I'm not supposed to want that, you know? So it's, gosh, it's a whole thing.
It's really interesting as well, because I think the mainstream narrative around attachment styles, and I agree with you, I think attachment style labels can be quite reductive, and it's similar to what you say about, you know, like left and right politics and how like defined people like to make them. And it's the same with like anxious and avoidant. And I think that a lot of people tend to blame avoidant people. In the narrative, avoidant people are always the one that are the bad people, and anxious people are like the innocent victims in all of this. But actually, the more I've learned about attachment theory, the more I realize that I am just like two people make this relationship. well, in my relationship, there's only two people, but so, each to their own. But two people make that my relationship, and we are equal in how we show up in that relationship and managing ourselves. And I have done my hardest and gone to therapy and read books and written a book so I can understand more about my anxious attachment style. And for me, I'm just as culpable in a relationship breakdown as, say, my avoidant partner would be. But where I think the similarities are between when you pull away when you're avoidant and when I get overwhelmed being anxious, it's nervous system dysregulation on both sides. Mm. And it's interesting how, say, when I've had really bad anxiety in the past, I might have a panic attack. But I now know how to regulate my nervous system to bring me down from that. So if I feel that I'm triggered by something, I have sort of steps that I can go through to calm myself down. And yeah. I guess I get flooded with anxiety and you get flooded with, oh my gosh, I must pull away from this situation. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's both of those situations and nervous system dysregulation. And it's just de-escalating that and learning how to de-escalate that.
Yes, I love that. I love that because it's so practical and kind of mm-hmm. rooted in something that's tangible, you know. Mm-hmm. So how do you do it when you find yourself in that moment of being flooded by so many emotions? How do you get yourself out of that space?
I can't remember if this is something I heard on your podcast or a different podcast. I listen to a lot of like self-help podcasts. But there was, it's just beginning a sentence, getting out my journal and writing the truth is, and just mm-hmm. writing completely. And I also remember listening to your episode. I think you were saying that you would journal and you would not be honest in your journal. You would write as though yes. your partner was reading. And gosh. It's about taking that narrative out of your head and the perception of what other people would think and just writing your honest truth in your heart mm. about what you're feeling. So if you're pulling away from a situation, you need to write with complete honesty and integrity about what the truth is that is causing you to feel that way. So for example, when I felt anxious before, often my truth has been, they're going to abandon me, they hate me, they don't fancy me anymore. And it's all been like really negative self-talk. And then when you write that down on a piece of paper, the next thing to do is, and the evidence for this is, and
that's good.
When you have to put the evidence down, you're like, oh, actually, no, there's not really much evidence there about all this negative self-talk, because we spiral. And I do think avoidant yes. and anxious people spiral in the same way.
Oh, yeah.
So they're the first things that I would do. I would try and work out what I was saying to myself in my head. And I've got into, I might not be saying this right, neuroplasticity recently, because the brain, when you have a particular type of attachment style or any way of relating to people, your brain will, someone described this as a toboggan run. So if your way of normally dealing with feeling flooded in a relationship is to pull away, that is because that's how your brain knows how to be safe. Mm-hmm. So you go down the toboggan run really easily, and your toboggan run is, I must pull away and I must not speak on this, and down you go, down the toboggan run. But what you actually need to do is rewire the neurons in your brain so that like healthy behavior becomes your toboggan run. But to get to that healthy behavior toboggan run, you first got to like snowplow like up a hill in snowshoes.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I love that. I love that so much, because it's like, it's something that I always teach and talk about and really have been working so hard at applying in my relationships. Because it takes me back to the quote that you mentioned, I'm paraphrasing, but around a relationship breaks down because of so many missed opportunities to have those difficult conversations, right? Which can be seemingly small. Those little things that you feel you have a visceral response to it, but you think it feels silly to say this or whatever it might be. So I love what you're saying, because I think it really is in those micro moments. And that's something that for me, I even just love the language of micro moments. You're not trying to make this huge shift and trying to change the way your brain works overnight, but it's in those micro moments, similar to when I talk about brave expression and liberating your voice. Don't wait for the big audacious moment when you have to use it. It's in those little moments when at the restaurant, there's way too much fucking salt in your pasta. The waiter comes over smiling at you. How is everything? And you instinctively want to say, oh, it's fine. It's great. No, say, actually, the service is really good, but this pasta is a little bit salty. Can I get it replaced? It can be something like that. I don't know, something, right?
And it doesn't even have to be, like you say, it doesn't even have to be a confrontational thing. You can deliver your message in with love and care and positive reinforcement. You don't have to be like blunt and horrible about it. But what I find is that when people self-censor themselves in these minor moments in life, like the salty pasta, it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And then one day they just burst into flames and everyone's like, what's going on?
Absolutely. Like, where is this coming from? Right. You will explode one day. Mm-hmm. Now apply that same thing to relationships.
Exactly as you're Africa. Saying. Yes. Yes.
Over time, over time, over time. And then it seems like suddenly, where is this coming from? You were happy 2 weeks ago, a month ago, a year ago. So I think for me, even as I, even though it's not something I'm even thinking about now, I think preparing yourself for bringing people into your life is a state we should always be in, and not even just romantically, right? Because people will come into your life from a business perspective, familial, whatever it might be. And I think for me, as someone that does know they want to have a partner, whatever shape that looks like, I know that I want to have a partner. I do want to be prepared for the relationship. And I think part of my preparation is practicing having difficult conversations in those micro moments, but specifically when it comes to romance, when I'm dating, when I immediately see that I might have this incredible chemistry with this person, but there's this thing that I know is a fundamental need for me, and this person might not be able to meet it. And then I can have a conversation with that person, but I can also make peace with the fact that here is where I close the door. I don't have to do this for a year. I don't have to do this for 2.5 years and then make the decision that I knew I needed to make 2 years ago. You know what I mean? But I think it's those micro moments of bravery that actually make the biggest difference.
Massively. Yes, massively. And it, once you realize that and you lean into that, I think it's such a liberating thing.
Yeah.
Because you're not wasting your time anymore.
Yes.
And the other thing that has really resonated with me that someone said once was, show up authentically so that the people that need to find you can find you. Because if you're biting your tongue all the time, your partner doesn't even know who you are.
Yes. Yes. And then they'll feel like they're being blindsided when you finally tell the truth, you know. Can you read me one of your favorite pieces from your book? Yeah, I mean, there's so many to choose from.
I'm having a little look as I wrote this poem called Writers as Lovers, which is, this is about fantasy bonding and about my I'll try and find that. 1 second, it's page 45.
Oh, perfect, because I was about to ask you to say, what page, so I can open my book.
Really long.
Yes. Oh, I love this. Found it.
So this poem was about a man that I met on a mountain in America, and we became in this... He ended up living in New Zealand during lockdown, and I was in the UK. And when we were sort of starved of any connection between people, we kind of got into this very fantasy bond. We had a little holiday romance back in 2018, and then we had this fantasy bond based on what it was going to be like when we were eventually reunited, which we never were reunited because he still lives in New Zealand. So I wrote this poem for him, and it was about me realizing, like I said to you earlier, that if somebody gives me a blank page as a writer, my imagination goes wild and I just make this whole beautiful projected story about what our romance would be, which is only based on text messages and voice notes. So this poem is called Writers as Lovers. We were only a few chapters in when I started to write our story. Drafted our future in my head. Worked you into my existing plot. You asked to read my initial scribbles. Sharing them with you is an intimate act. My hopes and dreams for us in pen on paper. In that moment, you are the only critic that matters to me. I watch your eyes light up as you see what I have planned. You call it a literary masterpiece. You tell me you want to read more. I let my imagination run wild and you devour the words. Stay up all night flicking through the pages. It is an addictive and all-consuming read. The ending is sudden. On paper, we have the perfect romance, but I created it alone. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. For the truth is, you love my writing, but you don't love me. I showed you my heart, but you read it as fiction.
Oh my goodness.
So that's kind of about being... that's one of the most raw and vulnerable poems I've ever written, because it was about, again, being in a romantic fantasy that wasn't rooted in spending any real time together. The only experience we had of spending together was a very brief holiday romance in 2018. And that had kind of fueled this whole story that was never going to come into fruition, if I was honest with myself. Like, practically, it was just never going to work. But the memories of that story and our time together kind of kept me going during isolation. So,
wow.
That is
that's probably one of the most powerful poems I've ever heard, especially in relation to the world that we live in today and what it looks like to be in relationship with people and how seemingly easy it is to be in relationship because of technological advancement, but how it is clearly not working for most of us. That is, wow. Please, if you're listening to this, whether you're experiencing heartbreak or not, because I think a lot of what you write in here can apply to most relationships. I really think that it can, because even that conversation of disposability, I've been thinking a lot about how it actually applies to friendships these days, you know. So I really think this is a potent book. So this is Heartbreak by Rebecca Archer. Are you going to write another book?
Eventually, yeah. I'm actually on a bit of a grief journey at the moment, and I have been thinking about writing about, because you know how, to me, heartbreak is such a universal experience, but it makes you feel alive and you realize the power and you realize the power of the emotions you felt and what you learned about yourself in that experience. And to me, grief is the same, in that death makes us realize that we're alive and it makes us realize what's important in life and who we really love and who we could not bear to be without. So the next book, I think, may be about the juxtaposition between grief and love and how it makes us feel alive. And maybe I'm contemplating writing a book about nostalgia as well, because I'm like an 80s baby and I love like the early noughts and like the 90s.
Yes.
And to me, it was just the best time of life. So I'm thinking of writing a nostalgia book.
Oh, we need it. We need it. I would absolutely inhale both of those books, actually. And something you just said reminds me of a line I pulled from one of our messages, from one of our DMs, where you said to me, heartbreak inspires and motivates more than any other human experience on the planet. That is so beautiful.
Thanks. Yeah, I think it does. And I don't know, there's a poem in my book called, now I don't know if I'm pronouncing this word right. I Googled it before I came on, but I believe it's pronounced Pangaea. And It's a geographical term, which is the belief that all the landmass in the earth used to all slot together. And because of all the sort of tectonic plate movements on the earth, so the volcanoes erupting and tsunamis and things, over thousands and millions of years, all the land masses have separated away. And there's a poem in my book called The Pangaea Heart, which is about when, if you imagine your heart like all the land mass on earth, and it's broken up and it floats away, and it goes through breakups, it goes through rifts, it goes through like extensive chemistry, like, you know, volcanoes and eruptions and things. But you can go through all of that, but it changes you, like, to your core. And the thing to remember is that you can go through all those deep, distressing experiences, but all the pieces of your heart are still there inside you. And you just need to bring them all back together.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's, wow. I have chills. Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you so, so much for this conversation. I feel like we could have just gone on and on. And I have a feeling that you will definitely be coming back so we can even just reflect on this conversation, because there's so much, you know. And I could feel that there were even parts of me that I want to explore more out loud with you, but I also have to honor the fact that I'm currently in it, you know. I'm nowhere even near kind of being in that mode of being so reflective and it being in the rear view, which is why this conversation was really potent and really timely and so beautiful for me. And the fact that you're also experiencing your heartbreak and you still showed up with me today and gave so much of yourself, I'm so, so grateful. So grateful for you.
Africa, I feel exactly the same about you. Do you know, I think the universe sometimes, one thing I've learned in my life is to lean in to the universe. I know that sounds a bit spiritual and crazy.
No.
But this is mad. I wrote this map about 2 years ago about people who I wanted to do podcast episodes with, and you were on there, you were like at the very top. And then when you turned up at my book launch party and you were sat on the front row, I was like, how did this happen?
Wow.
And it was just degrees of separation, wasn't it? Because one of my friends is also one of your friends. So yeah, I think sometimes if you just tell the universe what you want, everything will work out in the end.
I agree. That's why we have to be so intentional about what it is that we're saying, about what we're speaking onto our identities, because I truly believe the universe, the world is listening. There's so many energetic things that contribute to who we are and how life turns out that we can't see with our eyes, you know. But your book has really, really helped me in this past year. So to be able to speak with you and to share your voice with my audience, who are also going to be sharing it, and I hope getting this book and passing it on, I'm so, so grateful for that. So thank you. And where can people find you? How can people connect with you and go deeper?
So I'm on Instagram. My Instagram handle is wandering with an A. wandering_in_heels, which is quite unusual one. But I initially set up my Instagram account because I'm a beauty journalist by day, and it was mainly just sort of like editorial content that I used to do, like lifestyle content. And then I found a voice and started doing poetry and stuff on there instead. So that is my Instagram handle. And then my website, I had these books handmade in Shoreditch, so I only did 100 of these ones, so they were screen printed by hand. They're quite bougie.
They're so beautiful. It looks so beautiful on my table, which is where it lives, on my main table. And I have book number 42 out of 100.
So thank I've you. Got a few copies left on my website, which is wordsbyrebeccaarcher.com. But I can send you the link so you can put that in the notes.
Beautiful.
And then eventually, like in the next, hopefully in the next month, I'm going to be selling the hardback versions on Amazon as well. So, but that'll all be like, on my Instagram and on my website. So I'll let you know about that.
Okay, perfect. And if at any point you end up printing more or have more available, you can always let me and my team know, and then we'll update the show notes, because yeah. I know that this is going to be an episode that continues to live on. So Becca, thank you so, so much. And I can't wait to do this with you again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Africa. It's been a fabulous conversation. I've loved every minute of it. So, and it's so beautiful to be two women going through heartbreak together. And
I know.
Thriving. Yeah.
And thriving and holding each other up. And I know that there's so many more on the other end of this dialogue that are going to be just as thankful for this one. Ah, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.